Expert HR Weekly, compliance, good practice and benchmarking for UK HR professionals.
Hello and welcome to Expert HR Weekly with me, Cleo Springer. The government reported in its summer budget on the 8th of July that the UK's economic recovery is well established, with the economy growing by 3% in 2014 and with the labour market remaining strong. But how has this impacted on redundancy activity amongst employers during 2014? And how are things panning out for 2015? The latest Expert HR Redundancy Survey looks at the level of job losses during 2014 and survey respondents' predictions for 2015. In a second report, we look at how employers manage the redundancy process and, among other things, how they compensate the employees affected. I'm joined today by HR Practice Editor Noelle Murphy, who ran the survey and is going to talk us through some of the survey's findings. Good morning, Noelle.
Morning, Cleo.
Well, first of all, Noelle, can you tell us a little bit about your research and the types of organisations you surveyed?
Sure. So this is a regular survey that we conduct. The last time we conducted it was in 2011. This year, we heard from 366 organisations, and around two-thirds were in the private sector services, one in four in manufacturing and production, and the remainder were public sector organisations.
And was this a representative sample?
When we look by size, really, that's more representative. We had just under half employed between 1 and 249 employees, 3 in 10 between 250 and 999, and the remainder 1,000 or more. So by sector, we might have been slightly underrepresented in the public sector, but really quite a healthy and robust sample size.
Okay, so what's happening generally then with redundancies among the respondents?
So among our 366 respondents, two-thirds made redundancies in 2014. And this figure is really only slightly down on the 71% in 2011. Now, I suppose it's worth pointing out at this stage that this isn't a matched sample. So the population we surveyed in 2011 is different to the population we surveyed this year. However, we found that while the prevalence of redundancies continues, the national statistics would tell us that the actual number of redundancies is falling.
And did you notice any differences between the public and private sectors?
Yeah, we did. I mean, the public sector this time is outstripping the private sector. 80% of organisations in the public sector made redundancies in 2014. So that's a definite shift in the balance. We know that the public sector is still going through extensive issues around funding and budgets, and that an awful lot of cuts need to be made. And we can see that there within the number and the amount of redundancy programs in place.
And what about levels of voluntary redundancies? Did you make any findings on that?
Sure. So we asked respondents to tell us about the levels of compulsory redundancies and voluntary redundancies. We found that where two-thirds of organisations had made employees redundant on a compulsory basis, one in five had introduced voluntary redundancy programmes. And we found that more than one in six of our respondents ran both together. It'll come as no surprise that the level of voluntary redundancies is higher amongst the public sector. And one of the reasons we would offer for that is that public sector organisations are more likely to have recognition agreements with trade unions, and as part of that, an obligation and a commitment to try and minimise the number of compulsory redundancies.
Okay, well, you mentioned trade union involvement there, but are there any other reasons why employers might use voluntary redundancy?
Approaching a redundancy programme by seeking volunteers can have a much better overall impact on an organisation. It sets a very different tone from compulsory redundancies, both for those who leave the organisation and for those who stay. And organisations, of course, don't have to give everybody who applies for voluntary redundancies the right to leave the organisation using redundancy. So it allows them to control the skills that they retain within the organisation, but also manages morale a lot better. Totally reduces something like survival syndrome, which is the levels of feelings that are negative about the organisation for those who remain. So overall, voluntary redundancy programmes can have a much better impact on an organisation.
And do employees who accept voluntary redundancy tend to receive more generous compensation than those who are made compulsorily redundant?
So that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think previously, or some time ago, you would have found that one of the ways that they would incentivise people to apply for voluntary redundancy would be to increase or offer a more generous compensation. However, we found that out of the 129 employers who made people redundant on a voluntary basis, just 35 of them were offering more generous compensation.
Okay, so a change there over the time.
Yeah, definitely. The shift in emphasis, this and all of the findings that we're getting from this research is telling us that redundancy is now very commonplace and is almost like a workforce planning tool or a workforce engineering tool rather than just a reaction to difficult economic or trading conditions.
Okay, then we're moving on to compulsory redundancy, and you mentioned some of the background there. What kind of reasons are your respondents giving for having to make people compulsorily redundant?
The findings from this again corroborate with the overall findings from the survey, which is that redundancy is very much now a business tool. The top reason, and by far and away the top reason, was restructuring for internal organisational reasons. And that was, you know, more than 8 in 10 quoted that as the top reason. External economic pressures were mentioned by 3 in 10, and the same number mentioned changes to skill requirements. So we can see that, say, 3 in 10 are reacting to external economic pressures, but that is totally outstripped by the need to restructure for internal organisational reasons. So that's about wanting to change internally rather than as a reaction to what is happening externally in the economy.
And you think that the reasons that employers are making compulsory redundancies have changed over a recent period?
One of the things that we've really seen become more important as a reason for redundancies is changes to skills requirements, which again reinforces the feeling that emerged, or the findings that emerged from the survey, that in order to re-engineer the workforce, organisations are looking to redundancy so that they can meet the skills requirements that they have now and going forward.
And did you find any differences in between different sectors in terms of that trend?
This is where the public sector would stand differently. Certainly, external economic pressures were more prevalent amongst the public sector, as were the loss of funding, than respondents in either manufacturing and production or private sector services. And this isn't any big surprise, is it? The public sector has been going through extremely difficult times and suffered a bit of a time lag originally when everything came crashing down. Private sector had to respond very quickly. There was a bit of a time lag. The public sector is now certainly feeling the pain and having to make an awful lot of cuts, and particularly cuts within its workforce.
Okay, so let's move on to the consultation requirements now. But as you set out in the survey report, but just to remind our listeners now as well, where employers propose to make at least 20 employees redundant within a 90-day period, they have a statutory duty to inform and consult appropriate staff representatives as part of a collective consultation process. Regardless of the number of redundancies proposed, employers should always consult with employees about redundancies. I'll also add that where the employer proposes to make 100 or more employees redundant within a 90-day period, consultation must begin at least 45 days before the first dismissal takes place. That where the employer is proposing to make between 20 and 99 employees redundant, consultation must begin at least 30 days before the first dismissal. And we should also mention that where there are fewer than 20 redundancies proposed, there's no prescribed rule other than the overall requirement to carry out consultation with individuals about their redundancy. As a general rule, did you find that your respondents followed those timelines?
Yeah, when we look at the median consultation periods, they tracked them absolutely, 45 days and 30 days. When we look at the average, it's slightly higher, 66 days where there are 100 or more redundancies, and 46 days where there are between 20 and 99. What was interesting for us is when we started looking at the data for organisations and consultation periods when there's less than 20 redundancies. So there's no prescribed rules on consultation beyond that it has to be meaningful. But here we found that the median consultation period was also 30 days. What that is telling us is that employers like a time frame within which to conduct the consultation process for redundancies, even when it might be just a handful of redundancies. We did find, though, that the practice ranged from a minimum of 1 day to a maximum of 180 days. It's most likely that that 180 days is something that has been built into an agreement that is long-standing within the organisation, most likely with a trade union.
And And did your respondents generally feel that the consultation periods were adequate?
Yeah, they did, actually. Nearly all of them felt that the consultation periods were adequate. And we also asked them about if they felt the employees had enough time to get their head around it. Just 7% felt there was not enough consultation with employees.
Okay, Noelle, can you tell us now a little bit about the kind of steps that employers are taking to try and minimise the number of redundancies that they have to make?
So we know that an employer, once it starts to engage in the consultation process, has to start looking or has to take seriously any suggestions that are made by trade unions or staff representatives about minimising compulsory redundancies. And we found that the majority of our employers explored a range of options to try and minimise compulsory redundancies. If we look at the overall finding from this, which is that workforce planning and ensuring that organisations have the right skills going forward is very important, it'll come as no surprise that redeployment and retraining was one of the most commonly used alternatives. More than half look seriously at redeployment and retraining. Natural wastage, of course, will come as no surprise. So freezing posts, putting a recruitment freeze in place, and also just allowing the workforce numbers to diminish by natural wastage, those who leave and aren't replaced, and those who leave due to retirement. We also saw a reduction in the usage of agency or contract staff. Very pragmatic approaches taken by employers to minimise the amount that is spent on recruitment or on bringing in agency staff, and also looking to redeploy or retrain those employees who are already in position.
Okay, so let's move on now to the selection criteria that employers are using. What were your findings on this?
When we look at selection criteria that organisations are using, we see that the top most common one is looking at the levels and skills of competencies amongst employees. And the second most popular is assessment of past performance, which, as we know, is the strongest predictor of future performance. So both of those things together tell us and reinforce the overall finding that what organisations are seeking to do through redundancy programmes more and more is to ensure that they have the correct levels and correct type of skills in place within an organisation. And I suppose we can see this even more so when we look at cost savings. Just 25% of employers will look at how much they will save by making somebody redundant. So that's kind of interesting. It's not really featuring on a widespread basis when looking at the redundancy programme. The only caveat that we would offer there is that it is HR people who are responding to this survey. The financial decision might lay somewhere else in the decision chain when it comes to making people redundant.
Okay, so it sounds like the chosen selection criteria seem really to tie in with the reasons you mentioned earlier that are often given for making redundancies in the first place. So namely around workforce planning and the message we're getting that is employers' decisions are often motivated around this, rather than just being reactive to a need to reduce labour costs.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair summary there. And the whole thing about redundancy and the rules around it, so while it is more commonplace, it is still as important that employers continue to use due process when they do start to look at making employees redundant.
Okay, well, let's move on now to compensation and the redundancy packages that employers are offering. As we know, there's a statutory minimum redundancy payment, although employees do need 2 years' service to qualify for this. Statutory redundancy pay is based on years of service and age, and employees' weekly pay is subject to a statutory cap on that weekly pay. How many employers did you find are paying beyond the statutory minimum redundancy pay that's due?
So this is a really interesting question. We have very rich data in this area because it's very difficult to uncover what employers are doing when they pay beyond the statutory minimum. So the majority, around 6 in 10, are paying the statutory minimum for redundancy compensation. But that's still a very significant 1 in 3 that are choosing to pay more. And we found that while there are a wide array of formulas in place by employers to calculate redundancy compensation, they seem to cluster around offering either 2 weeks pay per year of service or 4 weeks pay per year of service.
Okay, and finally, Noelle, what are employers predicting is going to happen throughout the rest of 2015?
Well, I think it'll probably come as no surprise, given everything that we've said, that there's no let up in redundancies planned for the rest of this year. What is most stark when we look at the data and we start cutting it is if you look at the plans for organisations with 1,000 or more employees, 80% are predicting redundancies in 2015. in organisations of this size.
Okay, so there's some quite stark findings there.
Yeah, there is, yeah.
Okay, thank you, Noelle.
Thanks, Cleo.
And you can read the full reports on the 2015 Expert HR Survey into Employers' Redundancy Activity and Redundancy Policies and Procedures in the Survey Analysis Tool. The full data, including details of compensation packages offered, can be accessed via Expert HR's benchmarking service, which allows you to measure your organisation's practices and policies against industry standards. We also have a range of resources on Expert HR to help you comply with your legal obligations when the need to make redundancies arises. For example, practical how-to guidance on various aspects of the redundancy process and a wide range of model documents that can be adapted for your own use. And that brings us to the end of this week's Expert HR Weekly, which you've been listening to with me, Cleo Springer. We're back next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.
Expert HR Weekly, the latest from experthr.co.uk, the award-winning subscription service for HR professionals.